Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce Mr. Main, registration number 120, to the meeting.
Good morning, Chairman. I only own one share, but my broader family has about $100,000 in the company, and I'm a very small shareholder in, I think, about 12 of your other listed vehicles. Proxy holder for 197 additional shares today as well. Look, I can only say congratulations initially for a spectacular year. The stock's up from $66 to $91. You've become the world's biggest owner of infrastructure assets, and I think it's a fair comment to say you've joined what would be called the big three in terms of international success stories coming out of Australia, News Corp, Westfield and Macquarie Bank. Of course, there'll be plenty of bouquets flying today, but that doesn't mean there shouldn't be a few brickbats and a good chance for some rigorous debate. But my first very short introductory question before my allocated one question is, why are you so shy about your success? I mean, you don't even have any pictures of any of you bankers in the annual report. I mean, you're just a bunch of grey, faceless bankers, literally, if you look at the annual report. Why not be proud of what you've done and actually thump your chests and at least put your pictures in the annual report for a change?
Thank you, Swain. I think the newspapers do an adequate job in taking our photographs and drawing cartoons and things like that. So, look, we've decided up from now not to have photographs of people, but that doesn't mean that's a decision for all time.
Now, my serious question before I sit down, traditionally on the day of the AGM, someone in the press will come up with something designed to raise issues for the AGM. Today it's the back page of the Fin Review. A Mac Bank interest off the rails, the Chanticleer columnist declares. Company called Metronet, which has a $40 billion contract to maintain and upgrade the London Underground over 17 years, has just gone into administration. Thames Water, which we bought for almost $20 billion in December last year, is a shareholder. The Fin Review reports three other shareholders have written off a total of $303 million. But there's no information on our exposure specifically to Metronet. So my question is, what percentage shareholding does Thames Water have in Metronet? Did you know about this when you bought Thames Water? Now, the Thames Water picture is on the front page of this year's annual report, which usually means you've probably made at least $200 million out of the deal. Dyno Nobel was last year, and I think that profit was about $260 million. So obviously it was a fantastic transaction for the bank. Would you still put Thames Water on the cover after the apparent collapse of Metronet? And have we taken a write-off? Is there any ongoing exposure to it? And just can you tell us what happened and how you missed this one during due diligence? Thank you.
I'll ask Mr. Moss to comment in just a moment, but the amount involved in Metronet is very tiny. It was acquired prior to our acquisition of Thames Water, and it simply is not a transaction of any significance. But, Alan, is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, only, Chairman, that the various issues related to Metronet were largely identified in due diligence in the course of looking at Thames Water. But we assessed the value of Metronet as being... we assessed the value of the 20% that Thames Water has in Metronet as being worth less than 1% of the value that we assigned to the whole of Thames Water. So, frankly, it just didn't make any difference. It's just not a big enough part of the picture to make any difference.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Mr. Edwards, registration number 494, to the meeting.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, it's difficult to argue with success, and I echo the positive statements of Stephen Main that it has been a good year. It's almost sort of too good, and as echoed by your and Mr. Moss's statements, I just have one sort of question in the back of my mind, that it's so good, do either you or Mr. Moss see any possible black clouds on the horizon in terms of implications for Macquarie Bank of the rise in oil price or certain sectors of the American economy that could weaken? At the risk of being almost overly confident about the next year, do you see any potential dangers? I don't wish to be too much of a Jeremiah, yeah, but we have to sort of balance the good with the potential ungood part of it.
Yeah. I think the answer to that question is very much along the lines that at the moment we don't see any major negatives. In fact, if we compared the situation today versus 12 months ago, I think we would have been a bit more pessimistic 12 months ago in terms of the possibility of things like the US housing situation causing problems. Having said that, and so as of right now, the bank is going extremely well, as Mr. Moss mentioned, and we don't see any particular dark clouds on the horizon. Having said that, we do manage the bank every day against the possibility that something like that could arise. I mean, the one thing I think we're pretty certain that we know is that we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't make bets, and we don't take on positions that speculate that interest rates are going to go up or down, or that something else of significance is going to happen or not happen. It's important to realise that there are lots of uncertainties and they're very hard to predict.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Mr. Matthews, registration number 805, to the meeting.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman, and congratulations on an outstanding result. I think particularly in view of the movement in the Australian dollar, it's an absolutely outstanding result, and congratulations to all the board, management and staff. Could I, in my one question, ask you to comment on two things? The Taxation Commissioner spoke to the Australian Institute of Company Directors yesterday and said that one of the things that they were going to look at particularly was the tax paid by investment banks on fees. So that's the first thing, if you'd care to comment on that. And secondly, could you tell us something about succession planning at the bank? Please don't take this as an ageist comment, but it'd be comforting, I think, for shareholders to know that what's happening in that area. Thank you.
In relation to the tax question, I'm not privy to that. I might speculate that he's discussing the concessional tax treatment on private equity transactions that occurs in some overseas jurisdictions, but Gwen, do you know anything more about that?
Yeah, sure. Sure, Mr. Chairman. I mean, we're obviously a very large corporate, and as a result, very profitable, and one of the high taxpayers in the Australian market. So we're in active dialogue every year with the tax office in accordance with our tax administration responsibilities. We have a global business, so we have relationships with tax authorities all over the world. In some jurisdictions, we pay a very low rate of tax. When you think of some of the Asian jurisdictions, and in Australia, we pay different rates of tax depending on what type of income we earn. We have no outstanding issues of substance with the tax authorities, and no concerns about the planned review that the Commissioner has mentioned.
In relation to succession planning, let me just make a few comments. That's a comment that that's an area that the bank board takes very, very seriously. We have a major session on it around about November every year, in which we go right through the senior ranks of the bank and discuss sort of the possibilities if any one of a number of people were run over by the proverbial bus. At any one point in time, you've never got a perfect substitute for every position, but we certainly try and make sure that there are no big gaps that exist, and I'm confident that's the situation as of right now. In relation to the Chief Executive, my impression is that he gets a lot of pleasure out of his job, and he doesn't show any particular signs that I've detected of wanting to do anything else, and I think, like me, he's planning to be around for the foreseeable future.
Thanks, Chairman. A question on governance. I'm a shareholder in all of the vehicles, and I know there's been a big debate about potential conflict of interest between your funds and the bank and the way the fees flow. And part of your defence is that we just make an enormous amount of disclosure to the market on the financials of the funds. One thing I haven't actually been able to spot, and I may have missed it in the disclosures, is when a fund makes a big deal and the bank is the advisor, you never actually come out and say what the fee was. Now, for mine, that's actually a very material and important figure. And I'm a shareholder in Macquarie Communications Group. In the last 4 months, you've just splurged $10 billion on three deals, two in the UK, National Grid and Airwave, and Global Towers in the US. You've raised capital. I put $5,000 into the SPP. I've lost $300 or $400, I think, on that. You've put up here how these deals have all been great for the bank, but you've never actually disclosed how much in success fees or advisory fees or debt management fees you have extracted from me as a shareholder in MCG for that deal. And for mine, that is a clear-cut, related party transaction. You've got a foot in both camps. We need to see the figure. How do we know the figure is not exorbitant? We've just got to trust the independent directors. So why don't you disclose related party transactions on these deals specifically, deal by deal, so that the market, the investors can be assured that they're not being gouged? And you know, the obvious sort of incentive would be, if there's a $100 million success fee flowing from Thames Water to the bank, let's do the deal because the bank gets $100 million. And, you know, we can only guess what the fee is because we see Thames Water on the cover of the annual report. And I think that these figures should be disclosed. So I'd like some commentary as to why those figures aren't disclosed. And I'd like to bring in the auditor into that, Ian Hammond, and just have another aspect to this question. And that is that down at Babcock & Brown, they have a position where the auditor of the bank, Babcock & Brown, is Ernst & Young, and therefore there's a conflict of interest in having Ernst & Young being the auditor of any of the other associated funds. Now, I'm an investor in all of the other associated funds at Babcock as well, so I've seen this situation. Now, there's a bit of a problem down there at Babcock's because PricewaterhouseCoopers actually provides an office to the chairman of their audit committee, and for mine, they avoid one conflict and create another massive conflict because all the other funds happen to choose PwC, which happens to provide an office to the chairman of the Babcock's audit committee. Now, the situation at Macquarie is different. PwC gets the lot. So my question, perhaps Catherine Livingstone, as chairman of the audit committee, should come in on this one as well, is why do you have that position where it's okay for PwC to audit everything when it is different from the Babcock situation? And it comes back to the disclosure that why aren't we being told the transaction-specific fees, which are going to be running to tens of millions of dollars when the funds flow back and forth. So if you guys want to be, you know, on the high, you know, high-level governance, you want to be able to say that we're holier than now, I think these are the sorts of issues you need to deal with. They're only minor in the broader scheme of things about governance at Macquarie, but the auditor question, independent auditors of the funds, and better disclosure of the success fees for mine are probably two of the biggest crosses where you can make some serious advances if you make some changes. Thank you.
Well, I think, Mr. Wayne, you answered part of the question yourself by referring to the role of the independent directors on all of those funds. Whenever there is a related party transaction, the standard practice is that the Macquarie-related directors do not vote and that the entire decision is made by the independent directors. My understanding is that the fees, whilst perhaps not always disclosed on a transaction-by-transaction basis, are disclosed in the aggregate by the individual funds all the time. And on the auditor question, I'd prefer to wait till we come to dealing with the auditor at the end of this section when questions to the auditor can be advanced, can be put forward.
I think the earlier question stands, Chairman. I did have a couple of other issues I wanted to run through on general questions, so I'd like the auditor to respond to the earlier question. And the two other issues I wanted to raise in general questions were, speaking of Rotten Tomatoes, I think our Rotten Tomato of the year was hiring Brian Burke's firm. Why did we do it, and have you made any changes? Obviously, you know, most of their clients were sort of the, you know, colourful characters from out west, and Macquarie Bank, which was one real blue chip name, that East Coast blue chip name, had on their book. So you know, obviously regrettable, bad publicity. What changes have you made as a result of that? I noticed, for instance, in your political donations figures for 05-06 that you donated about $125,000 to Labor, seemingly every single state except for WA. Now, these figures are out of date. We haven't had any public disclosure of figures for 06-07, so I'd like to ask you, are your donations for 06-07 running at the same 320,000 or so that we saw in the publicly disclosed figures for 05-06? And most boards by now have made a decision about what they're going to do with the federal election. Could you enlighten us on what your decision is? Is it 100k each side? Or I mean, I've asked this at Tabcorp and Tattersalls, and each time they've come out and said, yes, we've just decided 40,000. So I don't think it's an unreasonable question to ask about whether you've taken a decision on that. And my other general question was, we walked away from Beaconsfield again. Fair bit of bad publicity. We sort of seem to be very generous in basically gifting part of our equity to Workers' Trust and to other parties. Why do we do that? It's not like Macquarie Bank to give up a seemingly lucrative position like that. And why are we continuing to have a knock-down, drag-em-out fight with the Australian in a defamation case over this Beaconsfield issue? I mean, I can tell you from experience, it's pretty tough work taking on the Murdoch Empire in any sense. They can inflict a lot of damage. And I just think from a PR point of view, battling away, massively expensive fight, going to court later this year, is not what you want to do with a brutal empire like Rupert's, particularly when he's about to own the Wall Street Journal as well. So why don't you just settle this thing and then you can be done with the whole Beaconsfield exposure, and we got out of it with a nice profit, and just move on. So just those issues, plus the response from the auditor, please.
Right, let me deal with the ones other than the auditor, then ask Mr. Hammond to deal with that one. In relation to the action for defamation against the Australian, I don't really think I can comment, given that that is the subject of a court action, and that's in progress, and as you've correctly observed, we are suing the Australian. In relation to the election, our policy has not changed over the years. I can't recall precisely what our budget this year is for political donations, but it's fully disclosed. The actual donations are fully disclosed. It's even-handed, and we believe in contributing to a healthy democracy through supporting both parties and encouraging both strong government and also a strong opposition. In relation to Mr. Burke, I don't think we... Did you want to say anything about that?
The decision to retain that consultancy, of course, that consultancy employed quite a number of consultants. It was a leading consultancy in Western Australia. The decision was made locally by the team there.
And could I ask Mr. Hammond to go up to the microphone to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Main, for your question. Can I answer the question this way? Firstly, under professional requirements, both in Australia and overseas, which I am governed by in my role as external auditor, there aren't any prohibitions on the same audit firm doing work for both the bank and the funds that it manages. Having said that, in practice, there is a mixture out there, but I would say that in the majority of circumstances, the banks and fund managers choose often to have the same firm do both the funds and the bank, and that is, you know, the practice in Australia is the practice with the major retail banks in Australia. From my perspective, ultimately, the decision is one for the directors of the funds, as the chairman has indicated. Let me close by just assuring Mr. Main that my firm and I do maintain independence from the bank as the external auditor of the bank, and we maintain independence from the funds managed by the banks. Thank you.
Just a one-liner first, Chairman. The profit share works at about 57% at some level. So if the shareholders have made $40 billion, does that mean the staff have made $50 billion?
No, because the staff don't participate in the value creation through share appreciation to anywhere near the same extent.
All right. Okay. Now, look, this is the resolution of the meeting. This is the main event today, everyone, because what's happened is Institutional Shareholder Services, which is the most powerful proxy advisory firm in the world, which has humbled companies from Rio Tinto to Zinifex and Oxiana with recommendations to their institutional clients to vote down resolutions, most notably remuneration reports, have this year just decided to take on the great Macquarie machine. And what has happened is they put out their report saying vote down the remuneration report, and Macquarie have launched probably the most vigorous campaign against such a report that's been seen in the Australian market. So there's been a hell of a debate behind the scenes, with Macquarie making representations to their major shareholders, to ISS, to others, saying in defence of the Macquarie model. And you have to say that the Macquarie model has been spectacularly successful. And I, for one, will be voting my one share in favour of the remuneration report on the basis that you shouldn't change a winning formula. However, there are a couple of rules of engagement which I think we need to establish at first, Chairman. Some of my questions are going to relate to the proxies, and I need to see the proxies to be able to ask the questions. So last year you withheld the proxies until the end of the debate, so we didn't see them until after lunch. And I'd ask you initially this year if you could change that policy, because the big event that will come out of today is how many shares were, after this amazing campaign, voted against the remuneration report. You know the figure, we don't. So could you enlighten us just on that one figure? How many shares, how many proxies were voted against the remuneration report this year?
Well, as I said last year, when we look around the world and look at best practice in this area, without any doubt, corporate governance recommendations are that you should not disclose proxies until which would potentially affect the vote. So we are going to disclose, as last year, we're going to disclose the proxies before the end of the meeting, but we're not going to disclose them before people are asked to vote.
Could I ask you to test the mood of the meeting on that? I think that it's absolutely immaterial for this discussion that we know this figure now. And the reason I say that is that I know that Macquarie has been making representations to institutions saying, if you're going to vote against us, please just abstain. Please don't actually take on the model, just abstain. And the other important point that I want to tease out today is the commercial relationships that Macquarie has with its major shareholders. And for me, that's the governance issue which is at the heart of this debate, is that Macquarie is the most powerful brand in the Australian financial system. Everyone needs to be on the train with Macquarie for floats and capital raisings and all this sort of stuff. So when Macquarie devotes their resources to persuading their institutional shareholders to vote a certain way, they have a lot of power behind that. And I mean, the example I'd give you is, for instance, AXA, which owns 13 million shares, is the second biggest shareholder in Macquarie. Now, when the French tried to mop up AXA, it was Macquarie that did the defence. So Macquarie has a commercial relationship as AXA's advisor, and they got paid very well to defend against the French. Fast forward 3 years, and AXA's being asked by Macquarie, please don't vote against our remuneration report, because this is the model that's made the machine, and if you really have to vote against it, please abstain. So, and then you can run similar arguments with the other major shareholders. So that's why, Chairman, I think for the purposes of an informed debate, it is reasonable that we be told the proxies at the outset. It's a non-binding resolution anyway. The actual figures don't matter a fig for the law, but the figures do matter for the purposes of this debate. Hence, my request that you test the meeting as to whether maybe it's after 15 minutes, maybe it's not right now, but before we finish discussing the remuneration report, I'd like to see the proxies so we can have some further discussion about what it all means, because if there is a big protest vote, it is a big challenge to the Macquarie model, which could have implications. So I think it's not an unreasonable request, and I'd ask you to test that with the meeting.
Mr. Mayne, as I think you know, motions can't be put on during the meeting from the floor. If you genuinely want to test this, I'd suggest you formally move a motion for next year. We've seriously considered the issue, and we believe that whilst there are arguments on both cases, best practice internationally and in Australia is that you don't bias the vote by disclosing the proxies, but you do disclose the proxies before the meeting. So at the end of the meeting, you'll know what the proxies are, but it'll be after you vote, not before you vote.
Chairman, I appreciate your right as chair to make determinations. The one request I'd have is the right to speak after the proxies are disclosed. Is that something you can afford me?
Let me take that on notice. I'd like to think about it.
I mean, I don't want to labour the point, but you talk about proxies the good governance argument is that we'll be intimidated. If we get the proxies, it'll squash the debate. Now, I can give you countless examples of the way boards opportunistically run the arguments. When Rupert Murdoch had 98% in favour of his move to America, he flashed up the proxies within 2 minutes of the meeting starting. He just said, there you go, you can all get stuffed. I've flogged you all. So that's the world's most powerful man. Okay, so you haven't done that, and the longer you hold out, the more I think you've actually suffered quite a protest, and you're sitting on it. I mean, that's the only conclusion that I can draw. And in talking about not wanting to intimidate, this is where the question of how big the protest is gets important, because you say you don't want us to be intimidated. Now, my concern is the way that you've conducted a little bit of a campaign with your major shareholders. And I'll cite you the example of, for instance, Barclays. Barclays own 13 million Macquarie Bank shares. They're our second biggest shareholder. Now, when Macquarie Communications Group had a share placement 6 or 8 weeks ago, they raised $700 million. You Macquarie bankers allocated to Barclays $60 million worth of shares. So they lifted their stake in MCG from 7% to 9%. Like everyone else in this market, they rely on the good grace of Macquarie that when you're doing a capital raising, that you'll put them at the front of the queue, you'll give them a big allocation. Now, if Barclays come out today and vote their 13 million shares against you and leave you with some egg on your face and some bad publicity, the temptation next time there's a capital raising at MCG or anywhere else is, well, sod Barclays, they voted against our REM report. And that's the behaviour, I'm not going to use the intimidation word, but that's the behaviour that worries me, because from what I understand, you have run a very vigorous campaign. Now, normally, when ISS says vote against the remuneration report, it runs at 30 to 40%. And if you come out today with 90%, and last year you got 95% in favour when ISS said vote in favour. So if you come out with 85%, others are going to say, what did you say to your major shareholders? Because there is, a potential conflict. You don't have to say anything on the phone. It will just be, we don't want to upset Macquarie. They play hard, they might punish us. So can you tell us, Chairman, about the way you've conducted yourselves as a bank with your major shareholders in attempting to persuade them to vote in favour of the remuneration report? What has been the level of the campaign that you have run to try and get the approval vote up as high as possible?
Mr. Mayne, can I make 3 points in relation to that comment? First of all, investor relations is a normal function that is carried in day in, day out, and that was part of what was going on. Secondly, ISS refused to give us a copy of their report and refused to circulate our report to shareholders, so we had no alternative but to contact shareholders directly. And thirdly, I can give you a complete assurance that there is no link to business and this vote. We didn't seek to make the link, and there was no link. So there is no, if we don't necessarily like it if they vote against the REM report, but we certainly don't. That does not bias our behaviour. And in fact, the people who are making those decisions, because of the way that Macquarie tends to decentralise decision making, are different people to the ones who are talking to them. And if they choose to take something like that into account, that's their business. It's not something we have in any way sought to influence.
Well, the groan index, this is my last contribution. The number one criticism from ISS about the Macquarie pay model is that there's an overemphasis on short-term cash bonuses. They say that, it's depending on how you argue it, it's 60, 70, on some measures up to 90% of pay in a year is the short-term cash bonus. And I guess some people are looking for you to give a bit of ground on this, to sort of say, well, okay, we won't just do 10% of the short-term bonus in shares, we'll do 20% in shares. And the other comment that's made is, what happens on the downside? So if something really bad happens at Macquarie, and we actually produce a loss, or something goes really, really wrong, Alan Moss has been paid $100 million of cash in the last decade. Cash. So he doesn't need to work. And he's only got, and I shouldn't say only, he's got $35 million worth of Macquarie Bank fully paid ordinary shares. So that, I think, demonstrates the point that there's been so much cash paid that if something bad does happen, many of you are at the level of not needing to worry. Whereas if you had a greater proportion of your pay tied up in options and tied up in shares that are based on vesting on length of service and things like that, it would provide better incentives. So that is the fundamental criticism that ISS is making. And I think that's the one that you need to actually specifically address today, is why it is necessary for Alan Moss to get $23 million short-term bonus, 90% of which is cash. Now, I know that you do lock up 20% of the short-term bonus, but you don't put it into shares. You lock it up in cash in Macquarie funds, and it sits there, and as long as he does his 10 years, he gets the cash. Yes, 10% is put into shares, but it's the preponderance and the reliance on large cash short-term bonuses which is at the core of the criticism, and I think you really do need to actually come out and specifically explain why you have to have a highest in the world model of short-term cash bonuses, different from your Wall Street competitors who do pay massive amounts of money but not so concentrated on short-term cash.
Well, can I correct a couple of facts? Firstly, there is no possible way in which less than 30% is withheld. The difference between some of the Wall Street systems is that they do withhold and put into shares higher than 30%, but generally the vesting period is much shorter than ours. Ours is 10 years. Often the Wall Street firms are 2, 3, 4 years. So after 2, 3, 4 years, they've got the lot in cash, whereas the 30% that we require to be withheld up front is withheld for and only gets to vest at the end of 10 years. The other point is that the 20% that is withheld is at risk not only as to income, but also as to capital gain, because they are linked to the funds that generally where the people work, or for the more senior levels, a blend of funds, so that if the Macquarie Airports, for example, went down and Macquarie Infrastructure Group went up, then the and someone had an element of both, they would be not only tracking the income of those funds, but also tracking the capital appreciation or depreciation of those funds. So it's not cash that's not at risk, it's fully at risk, including obviously that the shares are at risk, and so is the other 20%, and it's locked up more importantly for 10 years, which is, I think, a much more effective long-term sort of incentive, a much better alignment of long-term interest than a bigger amount in shares, which is free of any handcuffs in a short period of time.